Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 22nd, 2016, and welcome to episode 127 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and just basically shooting the breeze with some really great folks. Speaking of really great folks, I'm joined by three of them today. I'll start in with Ken Gagne. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Earl. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good out here in Portlandville. Also with us is Jack Nutting, all the way from Swedenville. How are you, Jack?
Hey, Earl, I'm pretty good.
Good.
Had a pretty busy weekend, outdoorsy stuff. Well, outdoorsy is in doing yard work. That's outdoorsy, right?
It is.
It counts. So.
And it's not too far from midsummer, is it?
We're getting there. A little over a month away, yeah.
Yeah.
Big Swedish midsummer holiday.
Holiday that I had the chance to celebrate once there, which was really fun. And also from the East Coast, but not the least coast, Paul Hagstrom.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going pretty well. I'm sort of trying to dig myself out of the many leftover projects that I have and having limited success, but things are going well.
It's a never-ending job. Just it's not the destination, it's the journey.
Right.
Speaking of destinations and journeys and other jagged segues, let me talk about today's host topic. Some of us, and I'm definitely including you in here, Paul, have large collections of vintage computers. We've purchased them, we use them, but then we, in some cases, tended to ignore them, stick them away somewhere. Maybe we picked them up in the early days, because back then, when we were first starting retro collecting, it was cheap, sometimes free, to pick up these computers. So we tended to be hoarders. I know I'm guilty of that. But then sometimes we just didn't use them, and they wound up feeling neglected. So I'll put this to you guys. I stole this gratuitously from the CC Tech mailing list, where some folks there weighed in on which systems they regretted not having touched for a while. But let me go over to Jack first. Jack, do you have anything in your collection that you feel needs a little bit more love?
Well, I do, actually. Most of what I've collected at this point is really not so much computers as video games. And one that I've totally neglected is the original Nintendo NES, which at the time that came out, I was not really interested in it. I was doing other stuff. I was a teenager. I was playing guitar. I was, you know, Mr. Other Stuff, like computers. Eh. But so anyway, years later, somebody gave me one. It's like, here, I don't want this. And a couple games and a couple of controllers, and I have never once plugged it in and tried to use it at all.
What?
Look, I know, it's terrible.
What are you waiting for?
I don't know. It's a good question. Well, of course, now it's in my garage, and God knows where it is. It's somewhere in there. So it's difficult now because it's hidden away somewhere. I've hidden it from myself. This is terrible.
It's behind that refrigerator, right?
Yeah.
Or the old 67 Mustang transmission or something like that.
All that stuff in the way.
Yeah. Well, Ken, as I recall, you're not too much of a hardware hoarder, so I don't know if this is going to be applicable to you, but I put the question to you anyway.
If you're talking about my tendency to collect retro computers, then you may be correct, but
if Jack has expanded that to include video games, then I have a couple of dozen consoles that I think qualify.
Ah, for sure.
So the one I would regret leaving in the closet would be an Atari 2600, very similar to Jack. This is one, it's not the one I grew up with. It's one that I traded some Sega Saturn games for about 20 years ago, and I continued to collect games for it as recently as 7 years ago, I think, buying them from a local comic book shop called That's Entertainment. And then I boxed it all up and put it away in some closet in my parents' house, and I recently rediscovered it just about 2 months ago. And it still hooks up and still works great. The only problem is, I know that I made a catalog of my inventory when I put this thing away in the closet 10 years ago, and I had about 45 games for it. And now when I unearthed it 2 months ago, I only have 30 games for it. I have turned my parents' house inside out and upside down looking for those last 15 games. I have no idea where they are.
Well, their treasure is waiting to be discovered. Perhaps buried in Alamogordo?
No, I have one of those. I actually
you do,
bought...
actually. You picked up one of those?
It's true. They went on, for those not in the know, we're talking about the E.T. cartridges that Atari buried 32 years ago in New Mexico, and some of them went on eBay last July during Kansas Fest, and it was during Javier's presentation that I suddenly shouted out, "Yes!" And everybody stopped and looked at me, and I'm like, "Sorry, eBay."
Very nice. That's excellent. Well, I hope those 15 cartridges turn up, and I love the 2600, but I never had that many games for it. My favorite of the ones that I did have was Battlezone, I think. Second only to Space Invaders, which I also loved on the 2600. Huh. Well, Paul, somewhere... buried in your vast collection of eBay rewards, I know you have to have a computer or console or something like that that you wish you'd done something with.
Yeah, I was just sort of like looking around, and most of the things that I have are in that category. Actually, I at a certain point I started thinking, oh, you know, like it might not be so easy to get these things. And there are certain things that I've targeted. You know, like I wanted to make sure I had a VIC-20. I wanted to make sure I had a, you know, SX64. I want to make sure I have, you know, various CPM machines. And you know, so I will get them, but then they just go in the pile. And so I think probably the one that I Well, there are two, I suppose, that I would probably put at the top of the list of things that I wish I'd spent more time with and hope to soon. One is the Next. I have a Next station that, you know, I used in the past and I wanted to get back and try to put together, but right now it just basically sits on my desk, you know, looking nice, but not actually connected to anything. And the other one that, you know, from my past that I would like to kind of use again is the QX10, which we keep talking about over and over again. And I still remember before I was even on the RCR having stolen the QX10, like I outbid Earl.
Not stolen, just simply outbid. That is fair and square.
I've always felt bad about that, but you know, so now I have it, and now it sits. It's both of these computers are visible, you know, on either side of my fancy iMac, but I haven't turned them on, and probably by now, time goes quickly. I mean, it's probably been a couple of years now.
The time does fly, and in fact, that's been the case also for my computer that I regret sitting in a drawer, which is also an Epson. It's an Epson PX8 laptop. And part of the reason that I regret not using this computer more than I do is that the user community for that particular machine is actually pretty small. It's a small universe of people interested in them. It did have a little bit of a resurgence when an outfit in Colorado had them new in the box, and people actually, they had about, I think, 75 of them, and people bought them out. So now they don't have any more, and it's good that they got out into the community, but you don't really hear a lot about it. Not much is made for it, that kind of thing. And I was able, using some software that a clever fellow had developed, to turn a Raspberry Pi, into a virtual disk drive for the PX8. And that was fun. And I thought that that would actually rekindle things, but then I got busy with some other stuff. And so there it sits. So hopefully over this summer, I'll be able to take some time and fire that up again.
Yeah, the PX8, if I remember right, wasn't that, I think, sort of late in its life, got acquired by DAC, maybe? I mean, like, didn't they sell it through the DAC catalog for a while?
Yes. It had, like, a renaissance through the DAC catalog. They hadn't sold very well when they were actually in production from Epson in the 1984-1985 timeframe, if I recall right. But they had done much better through the DAC surplus catalog, including some various software cartridges that were made for the PX8. They also sold well through that avenue. So that's what really kind of seeded the PX8 world, more so than when they'd been through the retail channels.
And that catalog, by the way, fantastic. I loved that catalog.
There were some neat things in the DAC catalog. Absolutely. So anyway, thanks CC Tech mailing list for allowing me to blatantly plagiarize your topic. And so I guess we'll move on to listener feedback. And I turn it over to the king of feedback, Mr. Paul Hagstrom.
Thank you. Thank you. You may be seated.
you tell he's an instructor.
Just a couple that I wanted to mention. Kevin wrote in to say that he evaluated the Eureka A4 device that we mentioned on the last episode. This is a Braille computer. He said that if you don't know Braille, it's not really possible to use it, and it is a computer on its own, not just a simple keyboard for another computer. It's actually designed to be a primary or secondary device for a blind person to use, and he observed that it has had a pretty good quality speech output that even did have a kind of an Australian accent. So that's kind of cool. I don't know if anyone... I haven't gone back to check that auction to see if anyone bought that. I didn't, but seems like a neat thing. And then Chris wrote in to thank us for mentioning his demo of the Ultimate Micro Power Supply Kit. And he wanted to point out that there's another demo video on Joe Strosnyder's YouTube channel called Joe's Computer Museum. I've sort of been peripherally aware of that channel, but I haven't watched it much. But there's quite a bit on there. I'm not sure if it's Apple II specific entirely or not. Probably not, given the name. But I will check that out, and we will have a link to that in the show notes as well.
Awesome. And thanks, everybody, for the feedback. We love getting the feedback. We read all the feedback. There's a couple folks that send us a bunch of links, and we do go through all of those links and take a look at those, too. So it's really neat. I think I'm going to swap a couple things around here. Jack, if you don't mind, I'm going to have you talk about Omnivore first.
Sure. Well, so last time we talked a bit about Omnivore, which is a tool for opening up and editing and checking out Atari 8-bit disk images. This is one that Rob McMullen of the Player Missile podcast has worked on. And we got a bit of feedback from Rob after our last episode. That's what we call it, right? Oh, last episode. And
show, farce.
He mentioned that one of the goals of Omnivore, the reason he wrote this thing in the first place, was because he wanted to mess around with the binary images for Jumpman. Like, that's like, he made this tool specifically for Jumpman because he wanted to make some new levels and stuff. And so there's actually been some headway made in this. So Rob, along with, what's that guy's name?
The name that must be
Rob
said.
And some guy, Rob and this guy, it's Kevin Savitz. They have actually released a couple of new images of Jumpman. One where they've modded it so you can actually start the game at any level, which is pretty great because for those who have not played Jumpman, the original on disc, which is both for the Atari 8-bit and the Commodore 64, like there were certain modes, that, like there was a random mode which would randomly dump you somewhere. But otherwise, some levels you could never get to unless you actually managed to play the whole game from start to finish. So it was tricky. But now you can actually jump to anyone you want. And one of the things that they did also is they began to create some new levels. So they were able to take the existing structures that are in the Jumpman game and make some new levels. Obviously, it's tougher to add things like new interactions, new enemy characters, but to make a new level with how to, you know, how to lay out the platforms and ropes and sliders and stuff, they've kind of got that all in place. So they've put out some links to some stuff you can download and play with. It's pretty cool.
That is wild.
And also, on top of that, they also recently interviewed Randy Glover, who was the creator of Jumpman. That's on the Antic podcast.
I have not heard that episode yet, but I really need to hear that episode. That is so incredibly cool. That's one of my favorite games in the history of ever. So,
yep.
Was a good very one. Nice.
By the way, they just recently made public a spreadsheet of their interviews on the Antic episode. So now that it's, you know, getting impossible to remember them all.
Right.
You can, unfortunately, I don't think there's a little, I wonder if you can fork it and like you can on GitHub, so you could put little check marks by all the ones you've heard. But anyway, we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. And actually, the other thing I was not aware of until fairly recently is that Jumpman did also exist on the Apple II. I heard some reference to it being actually a pretty poor version of it, but I have seen the box.
Yeah, they talked about that when they talked to Randy Glover, and he said he was not involved in it and didn't really know about it. It seemed like he seemed to indicate that it was probably not necessarily even officially licensed. It was just like it was not exactly a port. It was just somebody kind of ripping it off.
Well, it was still Epic's though.
Okay.
I mean, the box is Epic's.
Okay, I think Randy said he did not think so, but either he didn't know or I misheard.
Interesting. Anyway. Maybe we have a mystery at our hands, guys.
Anyway, I think that Kevin had also said that he had played it and it was not good, the Apple II version. So, what can you do?
Well, what I can do is talk about the next item, which I'll only mention briefly here because there's not much to say at this point. There's an Indiegogo campaign for coming out with a modern-day 64 computer modeled after the Commodore 64 and with the same sort of look as the original Breadbin model. And also there's a handheld version as well, and we've talked about a lot of that. They didn't meet their funding goal. In fact, they only got about two-thirds there. So my question is, how's that going to affect the dates and deliverables and how they're able to move forward with that? They did get $100,000, which ain't bad. I don't know if it'll be enough. So I guess we'll see. It sounds from the updates that they posted like they, the creators of the Indiegogo, think that it will be enough. So we'll watch it as it goes along, and we've got a link for that up in the show notes. I think it's a really interesting project, and I'm just wondering how they pivot from here. I mean, theoretically, the $150,000 was a milestone for some purpose, like to do the design or engineering needs or production needs or something like that. So, anyway.
If I'm not mistaken, I think somewhere in here it says that the project's going on regardless. I mean, like, they do address what happens if the funding goal isn't reached. I think this is just a way to get one earlier.
Right. They said that it could be delayed. And so I don't know exactly what that means, but we will continue to report on this as events develop. So now over to Ken. Ken, what is TechServe?
I'm so glad you asked, Earl. TechServe is a mom-and-pop Apple shop that has been serving New York City since 1987. I got the opportunity to visit there back in 2012, and thanks to one of its employees, got a behind-the-scenes tour. They have a back room, a training room, and lots of other places where there's just tons and tons of old Apple artifacts. Macintoshes, Apple IIs, Lisas, all sorts of cool stuff on display, some of which is still being used. For example, they have some really old Macs being used to display which number is being served, kind of like at a Genius Bar. If you're waiting for your turn, just check your ticket against the number on the old Mac hanging above the desk, and you'll see if it's your turn or not.
Ooh, fun.
Yeah, it was really cool. I was glad to have the opportunity to visit. It was our friends at Ivan Expert, that being Ivan Drucker, who connected me with the TechServe employee who got me behind the scenes. Unfortunately, it sounds like TechServe is feeling the pinch that is the result of both Apple's own inroads into retail as well as the proliferation of online ordering, and like a lot of old-school authorized Apple dealers, TechServe is going to have to make some changes to reflect this new economy. Specifically, they're going to continue serving small and medium-sized businesses with both sales, service, and support, but it sounds like they're going to be downsizing their retail and consumer-facing operations. The rent at their current location won't be able to support this new focus, so they are relocating, and that probably means doing away with a lot of the cool memorabilia that we have so enjoyed seeing upon any of our visits to their current location in New York City. I don't know what's going to happen to all those old machines, but if you've ever wanted to check out TechServe, you have until this September to visit them.
Oh.
Yeah.
Neat that they made it this far, though, and that they had that collection of artifacts, and it must be something, it must be satisfying at some level to have been in continuous business since 1987 in the computing world.
Yeah, 29 years, that is quite the run. I mean, this industry has had so many ups and downs, the dot-com bubble burst, new machines coming and going, and they've been there for just about all of it. And they're not going away, they're going to stay in business, but again, the part that people like you and me can just walk into a store and go, that is probably going to not happen quite so much moving forward.
Gotcha. Well, we're losing some of the oldies but goodies, both in the mom and pop world and also in the chain world. Did you folks have a chance to talk about the Dick Smith stores a couple weeks ago on the podcast? Because it sounds like that store chain is going under as well as the venerable Radio Shack. I know I was sad when the store that I worked in, HW Computers, when that chain finally went under. They'd tried to hang on as best they could and move along with the times, but it was just a different world. It was really neat having a storefront where we could sell the Atari 8-bit systems. So, Paul, what's a Monster 6502 and should we fear it?
This is a very cool project. So, I'm sure that we have in the past talked about Evil Mad Scientist. One of the things they make is this really cool 3-5s, which is a kit. It is a discrete 5-5-5 timer, but it is as big as your hand.
And nice.
It sort of, I think it blinks, but I mean, like it, you know, and actually I think it's functional as well. But so the guy who was behind that, Eric Schlapfer, I think, is collaborating with Evil Mad Scientist Laboratories and has made a big version of the 6502. So the Monster 6502 is it's a 12 by 15 inch circuit board that has all kinds of blinky lights on it and stuff. And it is it's a 6502 writ, you know, large, as it were. It looks wonderful. There are a bunch of little there are a bunch of photos with all the little LEDs running. They've fabricated a full-scale prototype, and I think it actually was at the I saw some photos from a Maker Faire that they were at with this thing. Here it is. Yeah, the 2016 Bay Area Maker Faire. So it's only a prototype. I think they are intending to make enough of them that it would be possible to get. I don't think they're going to be kits, though, because I think that's too complicated. it does not run at the full speed of an actual 6502 because of just, you know, the distances are large, and so has much larger capacitance, it says. So they expect it to run somewhere in the tens to hundreds of kilohertz range. So that means that you can't actually plug this thing into at least an Apple II because the RAM and video refresh couldn't handle that slow of a speed. But they said that maybe something like the Replica 1 might actually be able to use this as its main processor, just because it does all its RAM and video with modern, you know, components sort of sitting separate.
That would be hilarious.
Yeah. But it is really, it's quite cool. Even just artistically, you know, aesthetically, it's very nice. So everyone should look at this.
Yeah, they have the actual pads around the edge of the circuit board that correspond to what the pins would be. on a 6502. And it's a functional prototype, and I think they use some of the design specifications in that that have been, in the last few years, particularly well documented. I don't know if you've ever seen the Visual 6502 site where you can look at the address lines and the data lines and that of a 6502 as it's running a simulation. But a lot of work has been done on the 6502 to really understand that chip. So this is so cool. You got to watch the video on this. For those who haven't seen it, just go look at it right now.
We'll wait.
Yeah, we'll wait. Neat. That is a neat item, Paul. Another neat item that was sent to us from one of our listeners, from Bob, and thank you very much for this. There's a Hackaday write-up on someone who made an Amiga 2000 graphics processing unit, a GPU card, using an FPGA. And this caught my eye. I've been diving headfirst into FPGA stuff lately. So I went out and I took a look at this, and I don't want to spoil a bunch of it. Let's just say there are some marvelous feats of electrical engineering here, but the thing that impressed me most about this was the just get it done attitude. Apparently, in the first few boards that the developer went through, he did things wrong, he got things backwards, he got polarities reversed, he just, you know, was trying to kind of grind it till you find it sort of approach here, and wound up with something that works. And yet, one of these dogged determination kind of projects. I have so much respect for that, because I tend to be more, oh, I'm going to break it, you know, sort of fear factor. The people who get it done just jump in there and go, yeah, whatever. If I break it, I break it. I'm just going to do this super cool thing that people are going to love. So the write-ups on Hackaday, also a much more extensive write-up, including some diagnostic tools that he wrote for this, and technical specifications, the whole nine yards, you can find on GitHub, and we'll have a link to that too. And I really enjoyed looking at this, and hats off to you. So, Ken, what is an arcade with a T?
Arcade? Good question, Earl. I'll let you know what that is. That is a book of classic arcade game art. It is, in the interest of full disclosure, a Kickstarter that I backed about umpteen years ago, as most Kickstarters tend to be. It was regularly, frequently delayed and postponed, and it eventually came out just earlier this year. This is a gorgeous hardcover book that captures the marquee art found on classic arcade coin-ops. You remember those?
I do, and these pages look gorgeous.
Right? Yeah, so this is the stuff that is immediately above the monitor in arcade cabinets, arcade machines. And it has all the favorite classics like Pac-Man, Space Invaders, Donkey Kong, Q-Bert, so many others, and some lesser-known ones as well as interviews with some of the artists who actually created these. It is about, I think, 300 pages, and it is, yeah, 324 pages, hardcover, and it's a surprisingly affordable £25 that converts based on where you are, of course. So I got mine in the mail about a few weeks ago, and I shot an unboxing video, which I haven't finished editing and posting yet, but it really is a great coffee table book or a collector's book for your bookshelf. And let's see, do they have a paperback? There's a PDF edition that you can get for only £10. I actually got both versions as a result of being a Kickstarter backer, and I didn't open the PDF yet. I wanted to wait for the hardcover to arrive, so I'd be nice and surprised. But it's available from bitmapbooks.co.uk. There will be a link in the show notes.
Are you going to do an unboxing video on the PDF?
You know, I have done unboxing videos on some Steam games before, and it's just a video of the download thermometer filling up. And sometimes those videos get more views than my actual gameplay videos. Like, one person left a comment saying, why did I just watch you download a game? And I wrote back, good question. I don't know.
You've got the best progress bars.
I know, right?
Of anyone on YouTube.
And they're so easy to fake. Like, I was downloading something to my Xbox One, and I said, connect, speed up download. And in Final Cut Pro, I just sped up the download by like 600%. And people were like, oh my God, does that work? And they would go home and they'd try, and they're like, oh, it didn't work for me. Do you have FiOS? How do I do it? I'm like, guys, really?
That is too funny. But this is a beautiful work of art. Man, I'm jealous. So you opened this up. How are the pages? What's the quality of the actual stock?
It's really, really good quality. I mean, I don't work in the print manufacturing business, so I really don't know the names of like the different kinds of paper or their weight, but this is really high quality, shiny paper. Really
feels
does,
good.
Yeah, it captures the quality of the original art. I mean, this is an art book, and you need to have a quality of manufacture that is appropriate for that medium, and he really captured it. I know the creator, Tim Nichols, went through a lot of crap to get this published. He worked with a lot of different vendors and publishers that some of them like closed up shop and took his money with them. And he had to sign a bunch of different contracts and blah, 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 and the legalese. And, you know, some people on Kickstarter can be very unsupportive when a creator encounters these obstacles. They feel like Kickstarter is a shop and they ordered something and they want their product. But for me, Kickstarter is just like a surprise that I send to future me. Oh, I don't remember ordering this 5 years ago, and now it just arrives in the mail. Exciting. And so,
you're right.
You
people
know,
do need patience.
Yeah, and I've never encountered the degree of obstacles that Tim has, but as somebody who has hosted podcasts and published magazines, I know that unexpected things can happen. And so when he got crap, I'm just like, hey, no rush. Make sure you do it right. Don't rush a product just to get into our hands and then regret the quality because it was rushed. So he took his time, and this product really shows off. Now, again, I did back the Kickstarter. I don't have any financial stake in its success. You might say that I'm trying to justify money well spent, but no, this is a good product. And if I saw this in a Barnes & Noble, having never heard of it before, I would be strongly tempted to plunk down £25 and buy it.
Cool. Very nice. Well, Paul, why don't you close us out on the news with some TPDD tools? It's not easy to say. Tango, Papa, Delta, Delta.
Tools.
Tools.
Yeah, so this actually just before we recorded came across the Model 100 mailing list. Gary Hammond, has put together a Python script for the Tandy portable disk drive, which is the disk drive that goes with the Model 100, Model 102, Tandy 200 computers. And so it's there. You know, there are a number of solutions where you can basically use some kind of external device to serve as a portable disk drive to your Model 100. I'm sure we've talked about some of these before. In fact, actually, as I was looking through some of those options, there was even one called DL Pilot that ran on the Palm platform for a long time. What surprised me, actually, when I was looking into this was that I didn't realize until just yesterday, basically, that the TPDD really is just a serial device. I guess it's got all of its brains inside of it, and all you do is just sort of like request data, and it sends data back.
That's
so
true.
It's actually, yeah, it's surprisingly easy to interface with this. But so there are a couple of things. There's something called DL Plus, and there's something called Laddie Con, and I think Laddie Alpha. Those I think we've talked about before. The thing that's new with the Tandy Portable Disk Drive tools is that it actually allows your modern computer to talk to a TPDD. So if you don't have a Model 100 or you just want, you know, have the disk drive and want to sort of quickly get things on and off the disks, this lets you plug the disk drive into your modern computer and you know, look at the file structure, send and receive files and rename things and stuff. It's written in Python, so it's comprehensible. And yeah, it looks pretty interesting, and it's a very niche thing. But I guess it is a way that you can kind of test to see if your drives work too, if you happen to have one or plural drives.
Very good. I do actually have one of those. I have the TPDD2, and I honestly don't think that it does work. And I've heard varying troubleshooting and diagnostic approaches you can take with it, and one of these days I will go ahead and do that because it's kind of fun, the idea of a portable floppy drive. It's just sort of a neat thing, battery operated. Well, very good. I'm going to next talk about the retro computing gift idea that you could get for your favorite retro computing podcast hosts. But before that, a word from our sponsor.
The integration factor, only from NEC. Computers and communication equipment must integrate fully, so all NEC computers, printers, fax machines, and PABXs work together and with other systems to multiply your business in your local office or around the world. And any NEC computers and communication equipment you buy in the future will integrate fully too. The integration factor, NEC.
Now on to the host retro computing gift idea. I thought, you know, how could you go wrong with a drone, especially if it's a teeny tiny pocket drone and it only costs $12.99 and it has great reviews on Amazon. So this is the Cheerson Mini Pocket Drone. It's 4-channel, 6-axis gyro, micro quadcopter. And you can do things like flip this thing on its head and fly it around the living room. And apparently, according to one of the commenters, you can let your cats play with it until they manage to bat it out of the air, at which point then you might just have drone dust on the floor. It sounds like a couple of the things that you can buy with this. You can buy some spare rotor blades. That might not be a bad idea. And also, it sounds like there are rotor blade protectors that you can get for it. And even though it's tiny, I think that's a great idea to get the rotor protectors just so that you don't accidentally whack somebody or, you know, put a little ding in your wall. But I just love this little guy. And I've seen lots of YouTube videos of variations of this type of drone, these little pocket drones flying around. And the thing is, it does take a little bit of practice and hand-eye coordination to actually make the thing not nosedive into the floor. But once you get that, then, like I say, for $13, how can you go wrong? What do you guys think?
I'm in. This is awesome.
It looks pretty cool, yeah. And pretty cheap. Radio Shack had some over the holidays, some little, not this kind and not quite this small, but I did have a chance to fly it around the store a little bit, and I was pretty bad. I mean, this one probably does too, but it had a kind of a stabilizer within it so that I could imagine being much worse at this, but it was doing some kind of thinking on its own about how to stay aloft, but I was still, you know, still like taking it into walls and things.
Well, they do have some brains on the inside, and in fact, you can calibrate them to understand what's level. There are instructions that come along with it, and also people have posted the instructions on how you calibrate it. And they say if you calibrate it before you take it up for the first time, that it's a lot easier to get it in the air without crashing it. So anyway, that's my gift. I try and keep them, you know, in the sub-$50 range when I can, and this time I went way under. So, woo.
Very nice.
So let me go over to Ken. Ken, what have you got for us on the eBay of things?
On the eBay, well, there is this other podcast that I've recently become a fan of called New Game Plus, where these three gamers who sound like they're in their mid to late 20s each week assign themselves a random classic video or computer game, play it for the first time, then come back and report their results from the perspective of a modern gamer. Hmm. This week's episode of New Game Plus, they are playing Lode Runner. This is a game that I actually picked out, so it wasn't random, and I was a guest on the show. But they told me something about this game that I did not know, which was that there was a board game version of Lode Runner. Did anybody else know this?
I didn't know that.
This is the first time I've seen that, and that is really super cool.
And it's by Broderbund.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Lode Runner was ported to pretty much every platform possible. I didn't know board games was one of them.
The table.
So this apparently came out in Japan only in 1986 and is currently on eBay with a buy-it-now price of $130. According to the description, it does not appear to be missing any parts. It has 32 barrels. I don't know if that's a Donkey Kong reference. 2 dice, 24 chance cards, 25 blue counters, 5 runners, 5 guards, and 4 boards, each with 2 sides. So this is a game for 2 to 4 players or 5 to 6 players. And it looks like a classic old Milton Bradley style board game box. It doesn't say Milton Bradley on it. In fact, the company is Tsukuda Original, which is the clue that this was in Japan only. But it looks really cool, and I really want to play it because I was a huge fan of board games when I was a kid, even though in hindsight the games I was playing, like Monopoly or Yahtzee or Candyland, weren't really all that great. But I still have that love for board games and card games, and I still have a small, modest collection of my own, and I would love to add Loadrunner to it because imagine having a friend over and me saying, hey, want to play Loadrunner? And they say, sure. And they go to sit at the Apple II, and I'm like, we're playing this version.
Yeah, this would be great for Kansas Fest.
I know, right? Maybe we should do like a Indiegogo and get everybody to chip in. It can be like a Kansas Fest communal board game.
Perhaps.
I think that seems like an appropriate use of our resources.
Yeah, I'm searching eBay now to see if there are any more, but this seems to be the only one. I will have to keep my eye on this. $130 is a bit much, but this is something.
Right?
This is cool.
Yeah, so my thanks to the young men at New Game Plus for teaching me a thing or two about Loadrunner.
All right, Paul. Well, as I've challenged you before, top that.
Oh, is it me? All right. Well, I have a couple of just miscellaneous things, as usual. So the first one is a work slate. What is the name of it? Convergent? Yeah, Convergent Work Slate. And so I'm not sure if we've talked about these before. I think it was probably supposed to compete with like the Model 100 and that sort of thing. But it's one of its primary uses was for just doing like spreadsheets. And so I've seen them before. They're kind of hard to do anything with if you have one. There weren't many of them, and there's not much that you can do with them, but what's interesting about this particular auction is that I have never seen such a complete thing. This has got the boxes, it's got a little micro printer, it's got some printer pens, it's got a bunch of what looked to be software on cassette. I'm not actually sure if those are cassettes or cartridges, but there are they seem to be still wrapped. It's all the manuals. If you were ever interested in a work slate, this is the one to be interested in. This is really quite amazing. I'm not sure if you were interested in a work slate, but if you were. So right now this is a starting bid of $100, basically. It's in Berkeley, California, and it has a reserve of who knows what. But it's interesting to look at it at any rate. Has anyone seen these before?
I haven't, and it looks pretty cool.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't decide if I want one. it seems like it would be interesting, but it would go to kind of low on the project pile, I'm afraid. So another one that I came across is this really kind of weird, interesting looking thing called the Zorba Modular Micros Inc. Zorba. It seems to be, I think it's a Z80 computer.
It's a CPM computer. Yeah. Seen a couple of these and they look really interesting. You see them from time to time.
It's just the look of it and the color scheme. It's very, very pleasing. It's sort of chocolate coffee kind of thing.
They say it works, but I don't know if I'm seeing any photos of it with anything on the screen.
True. Yeah, there are a couple of little chips and stuff in it, but it does seem like all of the pieces that you would need are there. Which is good. Apparently there was a carrying bag that this came with, and in fact actually wouldn't. The bag itself had openings for all the sort of ports and things so that you could leave it in the bag all the time to protect it. But the bag is not included with this, nor any software or manuals. But the rest of it does seem like it's all there, and it's interesting looking enough that the pictures are fun. It is a buy it now for $300, so it might be a little bit of a gamble unless that doesn't seem like much money to you. But and let's see. I think the last thing I will mention is a weird auction. So the auction itself is for game paddles for a ITT 2020. And so this is the weird looking little red and blue paddles. Doesn't look like very much, but it's sort of, I suspect these are extraordinarily rare things. So the ITT 2020 was an Apple II clone, that I think was primarily European.
Oh.
And so this is what appears to be a specific connector for the ITT 2020 paddles. I'm actually kind of curious to know if that connector looks like it could conceivably be the same as the one that's on the side of the Bell & Howell black Apple II as well. There is a special paddle for that, but likely not. Likely both machines had sort of specific connections. But anyway, this is a thing that probably you will not very often get a chance to see. It's hard enough to find any information about the ITT 2020 itself. This miscellaneous peripheral for it has got to be super rare. So you can look at the auction and admire it. And if you have an ITT 2020, there might not be enough of you out there to compete for this. But starting at £1, it is located in the UK. So anyway, interesting to see.
I'd never heard of an ITT 2020 either, but the picture of it on Wikipedia, it looks just like an Apple II. Same case style, same keyboard. I mean, like the original Apple II.
Yeah, I don't think it was sanctioned in any way, but they didn't hide what they were trying to do.
No, if you put the two side by side, I think the logo would be one of the main differences.
Oh, actually, no. I was feeling like it was not quite right. This, I think they did. Wikipedia says that it was manufactured under a license, like the Bell & Howell, and I think I did know that. So it probably might actually be the same case source.
Oh, too. Cool. Cool. Well, yeah, it sure looks a lot like it. All right. Well, we're getting toward the end of the e-bang. We've almost spent all of our money. Jack, how can we spend our last few dollars here?
The last few dollars, I found, since we're talking about it earlier, I found a nice version of Jumpman for the Atari 8-bit on diskette.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it looks like this is actually, they say this is brand new.
It's shrink-wrapped. It looks like
it's in a bag, so could be good. Actually, I forgot how much I love the cover art for this thing also. It looks like Vectorgraph. It looks like Major Havoc, the old arcade game. It looks like vectorized thing, which is totally not the way Jumpman looks, but what are you going to do? Anyway, it will set you back about $21. I also found, but I'm not going to link to, a cassette version of this game for the Atari 8-bit, which has to just be a miserable experience. Because it's actually on two cassettes. That must be so... There's so many things that could go wrong in that scheme. Like, I can't even imagine trying to play that game. It must have been just heartache for anybody who tried to play it that way.
You know what I would have done, too, is I would have made sure that if you lost all your jump men like you died, that it wiped the game and made you load it again.
Yep, go back and rewind cassette one back to the beginning. Start all over.
You know, it's hard to tell sometimes, but this shrink wrap on the box, I'm looking at the picture of the back of the box, and it looks like the original stuff. It just, you know, it's just got that kind of, I am really old plastic look about it. Not like somebody just shrink wrapped me to pretend I'm new in box sort of thing.
No, it looks actually old.
It does. Yeah.
You could open this and catch a whiff of early 80s air.
80s air, we love it. Too bad Carrington's not here today. He loves letting that 80s air out of the box.
Actually, looking at it, I can see it's got one of those tiny round holes in the plastic.
Yeah, I was going to say. I think
so
the 80s
means
air.
The 80s air has already escaped.
Oh,
yeah. Dang.
Oh, oh well. Well, I'll close this out here. We could spend another $100 or more if we wanted to buy an NEC PC 6001A. Well, why would you want to do that? I don't know. They look really cool. I came across this as I was doing my eBay spelunking and realized that I had the chance to play with one of these back in the day. One of the store chains that I worked at was called Computer Stop, and we actually were a reseller of these NECs. In fact, at the time, I was a burgeoning programmer, and I thought about even writing some software for this. So I talked to our regional rep and said, hey, what sort of documentation on that could I get to actually create software for this guy? And they were a little more hungry for developers than some of the big names, because they were trying to compete with computers that had a lot better name brand recognition. But this was fun to play with, and as I recall, had a nice basic language also. So there it is, the PC-6001. Any of you guys ever encountered one of these?
I have not.
I misread the number. You know, earlier I had thought we were going to be talking about more like Model 100 things, but no, I haven't seen this, and it looks pretty interesting. It looks like it has a Z80 compatible brain.
I don't recall, actually, what the guts were of this guy.
It is pretty, though.
I noticed it has old-style Atari joystick ports.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I clicked on another one of these for sale on eBay that includes what looks like a Wiko joystick, standard Atari-style joystick, and a game called Canyon Climber on cartridge.
Oh, cool.
Huh.
Wow. This one, I just came across the way that I sort my eBay searching for the RCR is typically newly listed. I try and get things that, you know, might be there still when mm-hmm. the podcast comes out. So
sure.
I'll take a look at some of the other ones that are on there too.
The other one I saw has a buy it now price of $400. So it's an extra $300 for the joystick and game. So I don't know.
I might pass on that, actually. Well, that closes us out on eBay, and now we're going to go round our table today. I think today we are a perfect square with four of us. So, Ken, why don't I let you go first on any parting shots?
Sure. I just want to remind everybody that the end of this month, May 2016, is when early bird registration for Kansas Fest closes. Prices do go up on June 1st when late bird registration opens. If you want to attend Kansas Fest 2016, being held July 19th to the 24th at Rockhurst University in Kansas City, Missouri, surf on over to kansasfest.org and plunk down your cold hard cash. This will be my 19th year attending in a row, and I've never regretted a single one.
That is so cool. Is that the record?
Oh, certainly not. Up until last year, I believe Tony Diaz had attended every single Kansas Fest.
Yeah. He is unbeatable, I think, in the total number, even if the consecutive number went.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that there are some people who have been there every year I've been there, like Margaret Anderson. I can't remember ever not seeing her there.
Very cool.
Cool.
And Jack, I see that you have nothing to add in the show notes.
That is correct.
All right, pass. Paul, what about you?
Well, yeah. So suddenly, I have gotten a bunch of interesting stuff that I'm quite eager to play with. So I think I may have mentioned before that I'd picked up an Amiga 500 at a local MIT, you know, flea market thing. And I've gotten a lot of the pieces that I needed now. So I have a power supply and it seems to work. And I have a video adapter and you know, the A520 that plugs into the back. I recently got a GoTek drive. And I have the thing that you need in order to reprogram the firmware on the GoTek drive to make it emulate a floppy drive. So that's where I'm stuck on that project, because I can't get the Mac to talk to the chip because it's a Windows program and that annoys me greatly. But so there's that. But I'm kind of psyched to get that going. But the other thing is that there was a Craigslist listing just recently that said basically, you know, I have a bunch of stuff. You know, come get it. I'm going to it's going to go to the recycler. I have to move. And the stuff was amazing. So one of the things was an Apple IIe with an accelerator in it, and you know that's cool, but not unique. One of the things that he had was a Microprocessor 2, which I'm finding very interesting. It is a it's a like Chinese Apple II clone, and it's a little tiny thing. It has little chiclet keyboard, and it has there's a little adapter that you can stick in the side of it that lets you plug in an actual Apple II disk drive. It's one of the smallest Apple IIs there is. I mean, it's the machine itself is basically the same footprint as the disk drive. I have an external keyboard for it. It's not actually, so I played with it just a little bit, and I've scanned. I have a lot of the manuals and things, and a diagnostic tape that I want to try out. But it's not actually completely compatible with the Apple II. It is like some of the memory locations are different, so it's actually pretty poor. It's a pretty poor clone. But it's still interesting, and I think they were marketed fairly rigorously, but I don't. I had heard of these before. This is definitely the first one I've seen in person. Unless I didn't notice one at Kansas Fest in the past. But so that's pretty interesting. And another thing that I picked up in that same thing were a couple of these what appear to be basically high end Sony Unix laptops, basically called News. Apparently these were only available for very short time. I think that there were actual works, you know, desktop workstations made by Sony that were, you know, that preceded this, but they tried to make a laptop version of it. And I have two of these now. I haven't actually, I mean, both from the same source. I'd never heard of them before this, but, I haven't attempted to start them up, but they seem pretty serious. So I will try that out. And there was also a Macintosh 2, which I'm looking forward to seeing if I can salvage at all, because the battery did quite a number on the motherboard. But very interesting peripheral cards and things. So if nothing else, I can transplant a new brain. But I have to find a Mac 2. I've been, you know, ever since looking for replacement motherboards for the Mac 2, and none have yet come up. But what I don't want to do is get another Mac 2, because then I will feel like I have made no progress, because I can't take the motherboard out of one to put in the other, because then I still have one that's not complete. But anyway, so yeah, I'm pretty pleased about this new bunch of stuff that I just looked into. I'm gonna have plenty to play with from now until like 20 years after retirement.
Well, that's a good haul. One of the cool things about being in Portland is that there's so many retro computer enthusiasts here, but that has a downside in that any time a haul comes up like that, it's just like feeding frenzy. So, nice score. It'd be fun to hear you talk about some of that stuff as you go forward.
Yeah, definitely. I will be documenting what I, you know, particularly the News and MicroProfessor 2 thing, because I think there isn't much documentation out there.
Awesome. Well, for me, I've been spending a lot of my time doing the FPGA stuff that I mentioned earlier. I went whole hog here and I got an FPGA development board called the Zeebo, which is a combination of one of the more advanced Xilinx FPGAs and a dual-core ARM processor on the same silicon. So it's a single chip, kind of a hybrid sort of thing. I talked about it on Chicken Lips Radio also. So the things that are better to do with a processor where you don't need the extremely rigorous timing, you can do using the ARM cores. And the things where that either really lend themselves well to parallelism, or that you want some custom accelerated logic, you can do on the FPGA side of the chip, and they talk to each other really quickly because they're on the same silicon and optimized to do that. And it is a sophisticated architecture. I've been having to take a good amount of time here just reading and trying to figure out what the heck's going on, but I'm enjoying myself immensely, and I hope to hook this stuff up to some of my retro computing gear as soon as I can to do little accessories for this and that.
Cool.
And that's it for me, and I guess that's it for this show. You can find all the show notes for all the RCR shows ever in history at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this show and other things at the forum, the VC Federation Forum, at www.vcfed.org/forum. We point out this is the new home, but the same forums from the original vintage computer forums. So if you were there, now you should be here, because here's where it's at. You can follow the RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. We'd love you, if you're on Facebook, to come join our Facebook group. We're getting up there in terms of number of folks on the group and fun conversations. So it's the Retro Computing Roundtable Facebook group, and we'll have a link for that. You can send feedback to feedback at rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network, a very cool and growing list of podcasts that cover various retro topics, not just retro computing, but retro this and that. We'll have a link for that up in the show notes as well. If you enjoy the RCR, please write a review on iTunes. Helps other people find us, and it strokes our ego, which we really love. Thank you, gentlemen. Enjoyable as always, and until next time,
Retro Compute.
Yes!